Welcome to Intuitive Warrior. Hey everyone, welcome to the podcast. I am glad you're here and I'm excited to be bringing you today's episode with Dr. Tanya Dempsey. I was connected with Dr. Tanya about a year ago now, and she is just such a wealth of knowledge as it relates to autoimmune disorders and chronic disease. In fact, she's really an incredible expert in mast cell activation syndrome. And she's sought after internationally for her knowledge of this particular issue, as well as other forms of chronic immune dysregulation, and really uses a lot of integrative medicine to get to the root cause of a patient's illness. Her purpose is to understand why people get sick and to help patients understand their body and why it fails them when and how it does. I sat down with Dr. Dempsey to really explore her history working with what we're kind of calling in today's world mystery diseases. You know, these things that are relatively new or at least relatively much more common, I should say, than they've been in many years past for reasons unknown. And a lot of these are the ones that drive you crazy. They go undiagnosed for way too long. You know, people do the sort of roundabout the medical system. And because especially the role of mast cells is so robust and it's so complicated that a lot of doctors just don't touch it. And so a lot of these people with these mystery diseases end up just living with their problems and not understanding how to get to the root and how to unravel them. And that's exactly what Tanya Dempsey does for them. In today's show, we're going to talk about, you know, where her interest in these alternative healing modalities came from, the why questions that sadly not enough doctors really have the time, you know, to ask themselves. You know, when one of these mystery patients come in and they've got these bizarre symptoms that can't really be figured out, you know, a lot of doctors are just busy and they don't have time to keep asking why, but that's exactly what Tanya does. And we're so fortunate to be living in today's world where there's so many doctors now kind of, you know, coming off script a little bit and changing the way that they practice so that they can really delve into the issues that are affecting very real people in their everyday life. It was really interesting to learn about mast cells. I know my wife Amelia has issues with her mast cells. And so learning how these cells release chemicals that directly cause inflammation in the body was a real profound learning from this podcast. And by the way, these cells, these mast cells are everywhere. We've got them in our brains, our bladders, our prostates. I mean, you name it. So although they fly under the radar a lot, this podcast is going to bring y'all into the know about these mast cells. And then, you know, through a really, you know, you're going to hear my reaction. I couldn't believe it. Towards the end of the podcast, we start talking about food and we start talking about protein. And I was shocked, and maybe I shouldn't have been, but I was a little bit shocked to hear that Dr. Dempsey is a carnivore. And I was so interested in her perspective and her carnivore journey. And I was so grateful that she shared it and how that contributes to her living philosophy as a doc. So anyways, guys, I hope you enjoy today's podcast with Dr. Tanya Dempsey. Today's episode is brought to you by Force of Nature, a premium meat company from here in Austin, Texas, that has been revolutionizing agriculture since they were founded in 2019. Force of Nature products are sourced exclusively from ranchers across the country who are producing the most nourishing, highest quality foods on the planet through regenerative agriculture. Regenerative agriculture helps to heal our planet through practices that improve soil health, restore ecosystems, sequester carbon from the atmosphere, and contribute to a more resilient future for all of us. Force of Nature's line of premium quality meats includes everything from your steaks, grinds, and burgers to specialty sausages to their exclusive ancestral line, which contain highly nutritious organ meats ground right into your food. They offer an array of proteins, including beef, bison, venison, elk, wild boar, and chicken, and are available in over 4,000 stores across the country and online with nationwide shipping. I pick up some whenever I am at Whole Foods, and I order from them online all the time, every couple of months, because I want to make sure I have plenty in my deep freezer. Visit forceofnature.com today to explore their product line and learn more about their mission of indulging responsibly and feasting regeneratively. That's forceofnature.com. Mystery illnesses, and I'm so excited to dive into a few of those. But yeah, traditional medical care is much more sort of like siloed and much more, you know, a heart doctor and a brain doctor and a, you know, this kind of doctor. And so this conversation already, it's like this holistic approach. So where did you sort of, were you always this like outside the box doc, or were you sort of like, did you have some like moment that you said, this paradigm doesn't work? Or what's the backstory of how you became the physician you are now?
I love to talk about it because it's actually probably both. I came from sort of a background of and not even knowing really, and no one actually said we need to think about root cause, but I was sort of raised with that sort of mentality, that sort of philosophy in the home. My mother was always very sort of natural, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of more holistic,
right?
Probably is the word. And my grandmother was like a equivalent to a nurse practitioner in Europe and actually in Russia during World War II. And so they didn't have a lot of tools. They didn't have a lot of antibiotics or other medications to use during those times. So they relied a lot on a little bit more natural approach to healing. And so I think I was raised with that sort of philosophy. And so what was interesting to me is that I sort of lived my life a certain way. I was always thinking about, you know, how I could feel better, how I could be better. I got really into bodybuilding in medical school, and so I was really obsessed with, well, not obsessed, but I really loved to think about like how I could push my body and how I could eat well and feel well and get through medical school at the same time. And I did that. I trained. I didn't go on stage or anything, but like I wanted to just, you know, really optimize my health. That's what I looked at bodybuilding, not the bodybuilding way that may be bad for your body, but in the good way, where it was really about health. And so I was doing that and going to medical school, learning about, you know, disease management. Here's the disease. Here's how you know, this is the pill that you give to fix the disease. And I really kept the two worlds apart. I thought I had to keep the two worlds apart. I used to have this book that I used to carry around with me in med school. And I wish I remembered the name. I have to look it up. But it was like a book on nutrition and supplements. And I'd love to talk about, you know, different supplements, different ways to treat different things. And my med school colleagues would be like, what's in your book on, you know, whatever. But, you know, don't tell the professors what you're looking at there, because that's not what we talk about in medical school, right? We had the hour lecture on nutrition out of 4 years in medical school. And so, again, it was just like really like that was my private, you know, private part of me that I could not share with you know, the training that's that I was so doing. Insane. And it was, I know, I see you making faces. You're like, what? Yeah, it was really kind of nuts. I look back now and I'm thinking, why, you know, I wish I kind of like pushed a little more, but that's okay. You know, this is what I was doing. And, you know, finally, when I was out in practice and I was seeing patients, I was really, really struggling with what I knew worked, you know, what I knew about diet and vitamins and nutrition and lifestyle management and meditation and stress reduction, like all these things that I'm working on every day. And the patient comes in with blood pressure issues, high cholesterol, all these stomach pains, headaches, you know, all these various symptoms. And I know that there's more that I can do for them. But I'm required to treat them a certain way. That's sort of the paradigm. And
or you at don't one get point, paid.
Or I don't get, well, right. Exactly. And in fact, not only do I not get paid, but I get dinged more money. Like people take money from me. Oh, I'm not joking.
What?
I'm not joking. So this is around the time when I finally was like, I've got to get out of here. I've got to get out of the system. You know, the insurance companies, I work for a large multi-specialty group, which, you know, really contracted with these insurance companies and negotiated good rates. You know, and they would get a kickback in a sense. It's not really called a kickback, but it was like, you know, if your patients have a cholesterol over 200, under 200, that means they must be healthier. And so they're healthier. We're going to give, you know, your doctors a bonus. So we'll give you guys a bonus. The more people you have with good blood pressure control and cholesterol under 200, because that's the magic number. And so what would happen then is they would come to us. And they would show us our numbers and they would say, oh, Dr. Dempsey, your patients have, you know, you have more patients with cholesterol over 200 than your colleague down the hall. Why? Are you not using enough Lipitor? You know, this was like the conversation we would have. And then it was like, well, you know, we're going to start charging you $5 a patient for every patient that you have with a cholesterol over 200. No, this is real stuff. This is real, I'm telling you. And then in 3 months, if you don't get these people down, we're going to charge you $10 per patient that you don't put on Lipitor, essentially.
And didn't Lipitor, right? Just like as a quick, I want to keep this going because this is such important information and context for people to have. But when I was a kid, I think I was born in the mid 80s and I remember Lipitor commercials constantly and then they were just gone. They were all over.
Exactly.
So did that drug specifically like start killing people or something?
No, it's a great drug.
And okay. Look,
my background is I'm integrative. I use medication when I need, and I certainly have patients that need that drug or that group of drugs.
Yep.
There are some side effects, but there are also, you know, things that I try to do first to manage the patient's cholesterol. And I know that it's not just their total cholesterol that's the problem. It's much more than that. I want to know the intricacies of their particles and all these other measurements. And so the point is that, you know, that I don't want to just throw medication at people. I want to think about it. I want to work with them. I want to understand what all the pieces are. You know, a lot of patients who have high cholesterol actually have metabolic syndrome. They have insulin resistance. I want to deal with that. That's the root of the problem. The cholesterol's the sort of side effect of that. And so anyway, once they started charging me money for the patients not having a cholesterol in the 200, it was sort of like, all right, I've got to get out of here. And I have a colleague that I had met at a conference, and he was rather local. He's part of the Institute for Functional Medicine. And I was having a conversation. I was explaining my practice to him my approach to patients. And he said, and I actually didn't know that I was integrative. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I was doing, but I was an internist who was frustrated and really wanted to help people. And I talked a lot about root causes, but I never knew that that was a thing. I didn't know that people were actually talking about that. And so I was explaining to him what I was doing. And he said, oh, you're doing integrative medicine. And I said, that's a thing? There's a thing called integrative medicine? And he's like, yeah, you should go to the conferences, you know. So that was the start. And that was, you know, I just launched off of there, started my own practice and started doing really, really treating patients the way they deserve to be treated, the way I would have want to be treated, the way I want my family to be treated. And so I can spend the time, I can use medicine when I need, but I try to find different paths for everybody. And so that's kind of been my journey, is that I really know that what medicine needs right now, medicine's broken. It's a broken system. It's not enough time. Doctors don't listen to patients. They don't know their patients. I want to know my patients. I want to help them through the years, over the years, to reach their optimal health.
I love that. I love that mission. And it's so important just to kind of like go back to when you were in college and it was like this blasphemous thing to work out and like take vitamin C or something like that. Like, I think that's important to know because there's this, you know, I think on, you know, you go on Instagram and someone's saying, doctors don't get nutrition classes and like, you know, all of that. But the fact that it was almost like a competitor to the curriculum, it just seems...
It just seems interesting. And but then, of course,
and that was the number one med school in the country.
It's crazy.
Okay. I mean, I'm not saying anything bad. Yeah. I got the best medical education. I am so grateful for what I've learned. I'm grateful for the people I've met. It's not a dig against that. It's really just that the system is broken. Mm-hmm. And there's just too much sort of like a dichotomy between these different belief systems. And we really need to start to come together because we don't have all the answers. So let's talk and try to understand things in this way, you know, in a more holistic
I love that. And and you hit the nail on the head too. You're like, well, no, I have questions about, you know, I have clients or patients on, you know, cholesterol lowering drugs. And I think that's an important conversation too, because like where the middle is like every client doesn't have to be an emergency. Like if you, you know, if you're an extreme case, you have diabetes, you got to get some metformin or you got to whatever it is.
Exactly.
But this, we just went through this with a birth. So we just, our second son was just born like 3 weeks ago.
And congratulations.
Our first son, thank you so much. Our first son was born in a hospital. And after that experience, and I know there are, you know, this was like May 2020, like peak COVID hospital, right? Like just, and that experience was so heavy and traumatic, and it just, everything was such an emergency. And then just now, we just had our second child at home, and it was so easy. It was like, wow, we could do this in once or twice more, I think. So there's just this, when you treat the common medical system that we're trying to change and that is broken and that's like profit driven and all this stuff, it's like we still need like the emergency stuff. But like at the present, to me at least, it seems like we're treating everything like an emergency and not really taking that time to say, like, are you exercising? You know, I just had a, you know, I just saw a thing online today that's like a vet. If a dog's got a health issue, they say, the first thing they say is like, are you walking them and feeding them the right stuff? And like with a human, it's like, have you tried this drug? So,
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. Yeah. Actually, that's an interesting analogy.
Goodness. Goodness. So I would love, doctor, to get into some of these mystery diseases. You know what? I love that term. And, you know, what is a mystery disease? And how did you sort of like get into this work that you're doing?
You know, listen, because I was open to patients, that I really wanted to dig deep. I wanted to take a thorough history. When you start to do that, you sort of, you know, you learn a lot from patients. I learn every day from my patients are the best teachers, because I learn from their cases, and I take that information, I go back and I look more. And so in any case, I was open. So I think I attracted patients, right, who were like, oh yeah, that Dr. Dempsey, she, you know, will spend a lot of time with you. She really asks really good questions. Maybe she could, you know, figure it out. And so I started to, you know, to really enjoy that sort of process of working with the patients and trying to figure out how all the pieces fit together. And so to me, mystery illness really is that it's not really a mystery. It may be a mystery to maybe the 20 doctors that they saw before me or the 50 doctors they saw before me, because that they've not, those doctors have not come around to understanding that the complexity of the human body and why things can go wrong the way they go wrong. And because I am open to that and understand that, it becomes a non-mystery because we figure it out. But it's that sort of detective work that I do, that I really enjoy doing, that I sort of help to put the pieces together. Because the way I think about it is, you know, you have one body, and if you have a lot of different symptoms going on, they can't be unrelated. You can't have different pains, different symptoms that are completely different diseases. And this is what modern medicine wants to do. Yeah. They want to create a diagnostic chart, you know, like a chart of, or a list, I should say, of diagnosis codes. You know, they want you to have the hypertension code and the hyperlipidemia code and the migraine code and the irritable bowel code. And so you have all these different we call them ICD-10 codes that, you know, that they put through insurance, and that's, they track diseases, and they just want to give patients more and more, you know, diagnoses. But there's a reason why people have those diagnoses. They're not happening in a vacuum. You don't have migraines and irritable bowel syndrome, and they have nothing to do with each other. There has to be a connection. And that's what I love, is really trying to understand in our human body. I mean, there's a lot we don't understand, but there's some things that start to make sense when you start to understand how the immune system, how different organ systems sort of work together or work against each other. And then it sort of comes together. So for me, the mystery is really like, okay, you put the detective work in and everything becomes a little clearer. Again, it's not always easy, but I try to make sense of the disparate, you know, symptoms and diseases.
I mean, it makes total sense. Like how you, as you said, we have one body, and it's funny because my, you know, the majority of my career has been spent in the gym doing physical exercise with people. And even in that capacity, when someone would say like my left hip, I'd be like, no such thing. The pelvis is a circle. Like, you know, it's not, you don't actually have a left hip, you know, you have a left leg, but you know, it's one. And if the left hip goes backwards and it shifts, the right hip has to do something too. You can't, you know, it's like a steering wheel. You don't say your left steering wheel and your right steering wheel. And then in your work, it's like 10x that, right? It's like the, of course the liver has to know like what the intestines are doing and, you know, like all of this interconnectedness. And I love what you said too, is like, you don't necessarily know why the migraines and the bowel issue is happening simultaneously, but you have a hunch that they have to be in some way connected. And that sort of journey is what most docs, like, they probably say they don't have time or whatever the case may be, right. But yeah. Like asking the question is the most important thing, or at least like relying on some intuition and some, you know, on behalf of the client, even like, hey, these two things are probably connected. Let's think about it, you know?
Right. I think the best question or the best word that I can say over and over again when I meet with patients is why. That should be what doctors are always thinking about. The why. This is happening. Why? The patient has this. Why? The patient has these things. Why? 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 Actually, my brain never shuts off. I always think that, because once you start asking in that way, in that context, then you know, things start to become clearer. It forces you to look deeper, right. And you know, ultimately that's what's going to help the patient. But I love how you looked at it. You look at it the same way. That's great.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's an important question. And then you know, I think there's so much wisdom in the body. You know, I've done a lot of somatic type work and energy work, and it's like, this is obviously real. And, you know, I don't know what's happening necessarily, but there's a lot of wisdom stored in the body. So when you ask that question, why, you know, that patient, if they were in the right, like, office and like your office, like, even if they just said, well, let me think about it. Like, what could be causing this? If I was just to guess,
know, like, right.
Maybe your IBS is something to do with your diet. Maybe it's, you know, whatever.
Goodness. But I love that you bring up intuition, because I think that is actually, you know, a part of what I do. I mean, it's not, it has to be. There's so many pieces to the way I work. There's so many ways that you know, it's my brain thinking about things a certain way. It's reading the patient's energy. But I'm doing all this at the same time and not in a conscious way. But yes, there's some intuitiveness that goes into it. There's the again, reading the energy, reading body language, reading, right? There's so many things that will help me. These are the you know, the answers that I'm getting at the same time, and that helps me understand, okay, so maybe there are patients who really only have irritable bowel and nothing else, and it's not related to anything else. And I mean, of course, there's always going to be exceptions, but generally, right, the answers are there, and the patient has the answers. And that's the other thing, is that I can help, I can be the facilitator, but the patients really do have the answers themselves. I just have to help them find it.
Right. Right on. And it has to be a, yes, it, you know, and I, again, I've for 20 years been helping people with their diets and their exercise programs. And it's like, it's going to be dependent on them ultimately and tapping into that.
Exactly.
But I do want to kind of explore some of these. I have a couple of the diseases you work with specifically are relevant, but I want to start with Lyme because, yeah. Like, I don't even know what the heck Lyme is because there's, like, so many, you know, what is Lyme disease? Like, there's everyone is like don't search around for that because there's just, like, you know. So what is Lyme disease? Yeah. And then maybe I'll have some follow-up questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, well, that's actually kind of, opening up Pandora's box a little bit because, you know, Lyme disease is a very specific disease. It's caused by a bacteria called Borrelia burgdorferi. And that bacteria was found in Old Lyme, Connecticut, so they called it Lyme. And so Lyme disease is really a specific, you know, disease process that this bacteria causes in the body. And there's acute Lyme disease. You get a tick bite. It's transmitted by ticks. There are a subset of types of ticks that transmit it. You get a tick bite, you get acute Lyme, and then there are different stages after that of Lyme. And a lot of people wind up, you know, the people I'm seeing really wind up with chronic Lyme disease. And that's where that bacteria has sort of, you know, taken root and has started to really kind of destroy the immune process and some of the body tissue, and it's really wreaking havoc. The problem is that a lot of people say, oh, Lyme disease, I have Lyme disease, or, you know, Lyme disease is the problem. That's why a lot of people are sick. And the issue is that Lyme disease has become an umbrella term. And so there are other infections that these ticks can transmit. And there are insects that can transmit some of those same infections. And some of those infections could be things like ehrlichiosis is something that's transmitted by a tick, or Rocky Mountain spotted fever, babesiosis, Bartonella, tularemia. I mean, there's just like, again, there's actually probably hundreds at this point, maybe more, maybe thousands. So what has happened is that people are getting exposed to infection. Sometimes it's actually not even from a tick. Right, I said it could be from an insect. It could be from a bite of an animal. Bartonella is a bacteria that one of the forms of it can cause cat scratch fever. So you get scratched by a cat who has Bartonella. You wind up with the same sort of disease that you could get if you're bitten by a tick that carries Bartonella. So there are lots of different ways you can get these things. And so a lot of people have done a little bit of a disservice to this term. They've sort of said, oh, it's Lyme disease. Lyme disease is a very specific condition. These are different bacteria, parasites, viruses, things that you can get transmitted there. So I like to say they're vector-borne. They're transmitted by a vector. There's something that's like the transmitter. Could be an animal, could be a tick. And it's you're getting transmission of this infection, and that infection is taking root, and it's causing a really like inflammatory multi-system disease process in the body. And so I don't know if I made it more simple or more complex by explaining it, but that's kind of how I see it.
Well, that's it. You know, it's because my exposure to Lyme disease when I was a kid, it was like, don't get tick bites because you'll get Lyme. And then that was just sort of like, you know, a mystery disease then. But now it seems like in my adult life, it's these people that are bouncing around like 20 doctors, and then they think it's this and they think it's that. And then they're finally like, it was Lyme. And then that's like, you know, the final answer. And so that's why it seems like there's just like quite a story here. And then, so are those proper diagnoses, do you suspect, those people?
So that's a really, really interesting question, because I think that a good number of them have infection. Some of them have Lyme. They really do have, you know, that bacterial infection. Some of them actually have Bartonella, Babesia. Maybe they have a combination of them. Maybe they have other things. Yeah. So I think it's often a big piece of the puzzle for some patients. Infection. Now, it may not be vector-borne in that way. It might be, you know, Epstein-Barr. Now it could be long COVID, you know, or COVID, right? There are lots of infections. I think infection is definitely a big driver of disease. And by the way, vets know that in animals, they know that infection is a big driver of issues. They know that animals get parasites and they get bitten by ticks and get infection and they're treated very aggressively. In humans, I don't know. I think we just think like we are just, you know, invincible and we can overcome it. But the point is that I think infection is important. So I think, yes, a lot of patients who say I have Lyme disease probably have infection. I just am really cautious about being distinguishing between what the infection is, because those infections are treated differently. But very often, it's a piece of a bigger picture, because they don't just have that. There's a reason why after 20 doctors and 10 years of being sick, they're still sick. It's not just because of that infection, it's because of their immune response to the infection. So that's where I really, a lot of the focus of my practice is the immune system. I want to understand why some people can get exposed to Lyme disease or Bartonella or any of these others, and they don't get sick, or they get sick, but for very short periods of time, and they overcome it very quickly. So what makes these people different? What is it about their immune system? That's really like what I like to dig deep about. And, you know, what I have found is that there's a combination of factors. So first off, there's other environmental factors that sort of set the stage. So those environmental factors could be truly exogenous, sort of like outside the body. It could be mold. Mm. It could be you're living in a moldy home or working in a moldy office or having been raised in a moldy place. Maybe you're not living in mold now, but that set the stage for how your immune system worked or works right now. There are other toxins and other things that people are exposed to. There's stressors like, you know, different types of traumas. You know, some of them could be physical, could be mental, sexual. There are all kinds of traumas that set the stage for how the immune system reacts. And so often, again, this is like almost becomes a perfect storm. Mm. So maybe you were born in a home that's moldy. Maybe you've had some childhood events that made your life a little more stressful. Then you had, you know, you were exposed to a tick and you got an infection. You know, maybe you got mono, maybe you got nowadays COVID, maybe there's some other trauma that happened. And so it's an accumulation of events, and the immune system can only take so much and the body can only take so much. And so my interest is really, again, that immune part, which I really think is really rooted in mast cell activation syndrome. I think that, and we can talk more about that, but that is, I think, why people are still sick with Lyme disease, why they're still dealing with mold toxicity on some level, why they're having issues overcoming it. It's because there's an issue with their immune response.
And thank you so much, Doctor. So as you were speaking, it was coming up before you kind of elaborated a little, I started to think, I'm like, you know, I used to pull like 10 ticks a week off my dogs and they're like, you know, walking around fine. Like why, you know, how come someone got one bite and they're, you know, just completely messed up? And so there's this environmental, this kind of accumulative stress load, there's all of these other childhood stuff. There's all these other factors. And so that's also provides hope, because the doctor, absolutely, the dog's got 40 cases of Lyme disease. You've only got one. So it's just about getting these things dialed in and understanding the holistic picture. And I want to go into mast cell because I've got a lot to learn about it, but just to share quickly. So my wife, she's dealt with autoimmunity kind of her whole life. And one of the kind of big pieces, she had some really bad autoimmune flares that I won't go into, but like one of the kind of like
365 symptoms that she had was this, she couldn't run outside without getting hives and being itchy and miserable. And she was on Zyrtec daily for a while. And then when we got together, you know, there became this commitment to get off medic, because I was pretty like, you know, we could figure this out. So she wanted, you know, this was maybe 6-7 years ago, she wanted to get off Zyrtec. And so we did all this digging and found some mast cell stuff and, you know, got rid of the foods. But I want to get into this more. And I think just starting again, like we did with Lyme, like what the heck is it? And then we can kind of dive deep. But I know my wife's like, she's pretty good now, but I know she's dealing with it on some level still.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sorry that she's had to deal with it, but I, you know, glad to hear that she's overcome a lot. And, you know, really, and that's the thing about this, you know, I'll tell you a little bit about it, but the good news is that, it can be treated. For some people, it takes longer. It will always be there. It is not truly reversible in the way that we would hope it would be, but it can be quiescent. It could be, you know, quiet and not affect you like it may during flares. Okay, so that's the good news about it. But let's talk about it. Mast cells are your first line of defense as part of your immune system. They're part of the ancient immune system. We call it the innate immune system. And so the innate immune system is the primitive immune system that is just kind of like, I see something bad, I'm going to just fight it. Like, it's a very simple approach to dealing with it. We have another part of our immune system, which we call the adaptive immune system. So that's a little more advanced. That's the part of the immune system that, let's say, makes antibodies you get COVID, you make antibodies to COVID. That's that, and so that hopefully you won't get it again, or you won't get it for a period of time. That's adaptive. The innate is like, okay, I'm going to be the soldier and I'm going to kill. And so that's what sort of mast cells do. So they make granules of chemicals. We call them mediators. And when they see something bad, foreign to it, you know, they get a signal that's bad, and they literally explode. They degranulate. They release these granules of these mediators, these chemicals, in an attempt to kill whatever is there that's bad. And what's interesting about mast cells is that evolutionarily they seem to be really responsible for helping us deal with parasites. That's actually seems to me maybe their primary role. Parasites were a big issue, you know, from the beginning of time. And so I think, so infection in general is like one of their big roles. So you get exposed to something like a virus or a parasite or bacteria, and they're going to go after it. They're going to explode. They're going to release these chemicals. Those chemicals might help kill, maybe do something for that infection. But more often than not, those chemicals are backfiring. They're landing in our tissue. Mast cells are everywhere in the body. They're there. They're placed in the body where they're in contact with the environment. So they're there. They're ready. You release these chemicals, and the chemicals in the tissue causes inflammation. That's one of the problems, is that that their attempt to help us can backfire and actually hurt us. So mast cells are in the skin, in the respiratory tract, they're in the GI tract, they're in the nervous system and in the brain. They're again everywhere. They're in the genitourinary tract, so the bladder. They're in the ovaries. They're in the uterus and the prostate. You name it, they're there. And so again, and most people, you hope, is that their mast cells are normal. They're a lot of, again, everyone has them, and they will react to infection. So everyone has mast cells. Anyone who gets COVID, their mast cells will react. If they get Lyme, their mast cells will react. But you know, the hope is that these mast cells kind of like deal with what they're supposed to deal with, and then they reset. They sort of like go back and they go, okay, I'm just going to calm down. So a lot of infection, you know, people get, let's say, fever. They get like an acute part of their illness. Everything's inflamed. Maybe they get congested. But then the body sort of like deals with it, right? And the inflammation comes down. And the mast cells come down along with it. And I'm simplifying it because there are lots of other cells and lots of other things that are happening. But I think when I see it through the mast cell lens, it's easy. Mast cells are also the cells that are involved in allergy. So in addition to the fact that they're sort of helping with these things, they do read the environment, and they have a way of reading allergens in the environment. So if a person has an allergy, they, you know, may see, let's say pollen is something they're allergic to. Their mast cells see the pollen, releases those chemicals, causes an allergic reaction, right? And maybe that's the itchy eyes and the congestion, the asthma, the hives or whatever. So mast cells, again, they're involved in a lot of these different processes. So I think if you think about it from that, you know, perspective, it helps. Again, everyone has them. They're supposed to, they're supposed to kick in during these times. The problem is when they're not normal.
Right. Oh, that's what I was going to ask. Are the people with symptoms like have too many of them or overactive mast cells or like what's, because if I don't, my wife does, but we both have mast cells, like what's different about her?
Exactly. No, and that's the question. So, it's that some people have a baseline of abnormal mast cells, not the number of mast cells. Actually, there is a condition where there's a lot of mast cells, more mast cells than there should be, and that actually is a type of cancer, and it's called mastocytosis. That's a different condition. We're talking about people who have normal numbers of mast cells, but their mast cells are mutated. Okay. This is a mutational thing. The mast cells have acquired mutations, and often there's a genetic vulnerability. There's a susceptibility. Okay. So you see this in families. There's a flavor of this in families, but all family members can have different manifestations, different symptoms. But the condition is definitely hereditary on some level. These mast cells are mutated in a certain way, and so they are just a little bit more reactive than they should be. So there's no infection, there's nothing major going on, but they're like releasing these chemicals. And I keep talking about these chemicals, these mediators. One of them that some of, you know, the listeners may have heard of is histamine. That just happens to be one of the mediators that mast cells make. Mast cells make over 1,000 different chemicals. So histamine is the one everyone talks about, but there's a lot of them. And so at baseline, people who have this problem are just kind of like spewing out, their mast cells are spewing out these like little low levels of chemicals causing this low level of inflammation. And that can be in any part in the body, but it typically tends to be in multiple parts of the body at the same time. It's unusual to have it only in one body part. It usually has to have two or three different body parts, but the symptoms can be very vague and not, you know, not really significant. You could be very high functioning and have this going on. And then often what happens is that there's a trigger or some kind of initiating event. There's something that those mast cells get exposed to that brings them out. And it could be an infection. It could be COVID. It could be Lyme. It could be a mold exposure. It could be a trauma. It could be, the range of things that could happen. The mast cells then explode and release the chemicals and are trying to deal with that. But let's say that infection is taken care of and it's gone. Let's say we're talking about infection. The mast cells then actually try to go back down to a baseline, but that baseline is never going to be down to where they started. They establish a new baseline. So now they're a little bit more reactive. And they're causing a little bit more of a problem, but they're maybe better than during that flare. You know, then there's another flare, and that brings up the baseline again, and then the baseline again. So over time, if it's not taken care of, and people don't identify their triggers, and they don't take care of like the root causes, theoretically, you know, it could keep getting, you know, worse and worse. So our job is to not let that happen.
Right. Yeah. And I imagine it goes into, you know, all the other sort of stressors. And it's just so interesting because my wife had a near drowning as a kid. And I'm just like, I wonder if she like, because she had a lot of flares when she was young. And then now those are in control. But it's interesting how like, wow, like if something like that were to be a sort of, you know, manifesting event that just drove this pre-existing that was sort of under control condition into like a much larger problem. So what are like the, and maybe they're similar to mold and this mast cell thing, it's also,
I gather, something that a lot of regular docs aren't talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is that, like, someone comes in and they're, like, itchy and it's like, you have allergies, take this Zyrtec, you know, what's the sort of, like, path? What are, I guess, maybe the common symptoms, and then sort of, like, what's the typical patient that comes in and you diagnose this? Like, what's their previous, like, 24 months look like?
Yeah. You know, so first off, you know, there's some research that suggests that at least 17% of the population has this. And I think that's a low number. I think it's closer to 20% and maybe higher. But think about if we use 20%, right? 1 in 5 people have this. That's a lot of people. And that's a lot of people that doctors are seeing, right? So that's the first part of this. I think that this is a relatively new diagnosis. It really started becoming talked about, written about in the medical literature, you know, somewhere around like 2010. It's not been that long that people have, you know, really started to come around to this. So I think that's part of why a lot of doctors don't know about it. And I think that, listen, if they're treating it like allergy, it's not, in some ways, that's not bad. For the most part, a lot of patients that I see are not even, you know, treated like they have allergy. So that's a whole other part, because at least if you don't know anything and you give somebody some Zyrtec, maybe that will help a little bit. But unfortunately, a lot of patients are actually made to feel like they're crazy. You know, how can they have these symptoms? That doesn't make any sense, you know? And unfortunately, they're, you know, it's often a lot of gaslighting that's happening to them in the through the medical field. So it's really sad. The symptoms can be really, really diverse. So there are patients who have milder symptoms, some have more severe symptoms, but every system, I mentioned all the body parts that could be affected. So every system could have symptoms. So, you know, you start from the top, headaches, migraines, weird vision changes, you know, people who, you know, they have double vision, then it goes away, then they have trouble with peripheral vision, then it goes away. Sometimes they have issues with swallowing. They might have ringing in the ears. They might have digestive issues, not an uncommon symptom. Different types of digestive issues could be reflux, could be motility issues, could be they may have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. They may have constipation, diarrhea. They may have bladder issues, interstitial cystitis. They can have a lot of neurologic symptoms, not uncommon, neuropsych symptoms, anxiety, depression, OCD, tics. They can have numbness, tingling. They can have joint pain, muscle pain, hypermobility. I mean, autonomic dysfunction. So there's lots of symptoms, right? Thousands, actually. So a typical symptom that comes to me is someone who, you know, has been to many, many other doctors, and no one has been able to understand or put together why the symptoms in all these different body parts are happening at the same time, or you know, how can that be, right? How can a patient have so many symptoms? This is sort of what they're taught. And the thing is that some patients do have allergic type symptoms. You mentioned your wife was having hives, right, and rashes. Some patients have no allergic type symptoms whatsoever. And I think those are probably the harder ones to deal with, because those are the patients that it doesn't, like, if you have some hives, at least doctors are thinking, oh, maybe you need an antihistamine. Mm-hmm. But the patients who don't have those symptoms, who could still have mast cell activation syndrome, are kind of unfortunately ignored, or just, again, it just doesn't make sense to other doctors. But I'm hopeful that we're going to come around. I think this is why I do all this education. That's why I speak at medical conferences. You know, I'm going to get the word out, and we're going to start to take this seriously.
I love that. I love that. And like, how core is histamine? You mentioned it was one of many of these chemicals. And then does that tie into diet? Because that was the approach that we started to take, you know, in terms of, you know, we were doing many things, right? Throwing her in a cold plunge and everything else. But like the histamine in the diet, is it the same histamine that's released? So like someone's eating a lot of leftovers or wherever histamine is found in foods, like, is that relevant? Is it the same?
So for people where histamine is an issue for them. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the way I think about it is that there are going to be people whose mast cells don't really make that much histamine. They're making all these other chemicals. So maybe histamine is not an issue. Mm.
So, okay. Yeah. So even within the disease, like your mast cell is different than my mast cell.
Yes. Yes.
I wonder why doctors aren't figuring this out.
Exactly. The mutations I mentioned probably dictate which chemicals your mast cells are making and which ones mine are making. And even within the same body, the mast cells can be making different chemicals in different parts of the body. I mean, it's really.
So what the heck are we supposed to do about this? I don't even know how you figure out if someone has it, but if you do, you know, what the hell do you do about it? It seems like moving target.
You bring it a little bit, but think about the things that you sort of said about your wife and your approach, right? So let's just say, you know, because she had the hives, I think it's a reasonable approach to say, you know, maybe histamine isn't an issue for her, because that's a common symptom if histamine is your issue. And so for some people, I think about it like they have a histamine bucket. Their mast cells are releasing histamine. Maybe some of their food has histamine. Maybe they have trouble digesting histamine. They're missing that enzyme in their gut called DAO. They don't have enough of it. They're not breaking down. They have methylation issues, so they're not methylating histamine to get rid of it. There are lots of different ways how histamine is dealt with. So you have a person like your wife who maybe has a histamine issue. Then addressing the histamine, maybe cutting out food that has histamine, trying to help the body deal with the histamine better. That may be a really good approach, and that can help a lot of people. May not help everybody though, but that's definitely a great approach. It sounds like it helped her.
And she did. We did all the testing on her, and she also has the MTHFR thing. And so yeah, she went on all that. You know, whether it was like SAMe or B12 or folate, whatever it was, and then also reduced it in the diet, and then she did the DAO as well, and that was actually kind of the stack that just like really accelerated her. And again, it's been 5 years since I've talked about this, because now she's doing pretty darn well. But yeah, as you're speaking, I'm like, yeah, we also figured out she was, you know, had the methylation problem as well. So yeah, it's interesting.
So these are all the pieces. Yeah. So what I find is that some people in the mast cell community are kind of getting stuck in just talking about their mast cells themselves. And yes, we talk a lot about, what are we going to do about the mast cells and calm them down? But there are all these other processes in the body, like this methylation issue, like the digestive system and how you're digesting your nutrients and how you're digesting, whether you have this enzyme or not, how your body detoxes, how your body deals with the environment, how your nervous system deals with, you know, stress. Mm. So there are all these pieces that I'm always thinking about with the patients and trying to figure out for them, which is the path in to get the most, you know, most improvement.
Hey guys, sorry to interrupt the show. I am here to quickly tell you about a brand new way to consume your bone broth, because there is now an easier way than ever that's more nutritious than any commercially available broth that I have found. I'm talking about Beauty and the Broth's organic collagen-rich bone broth concentrates. In fact, they're so concentrated that even after water is added, they're said to be at least 5 times more nutrient dense than other bone broths on the market. Drinking or cooking with bone broth is an incredible way to support your gut health, strengthen your immune system, aid digestion, and nourish your skin. To learn more about Beauty and the Broth's incredible quality standards, their slow simmer and steam process, and to try their products for yourself, head on over to thebeautyandthebroth.com. That's thebeautyandthebroth.com. And use code RUNGA15 for 15% off any one-time box. That's thebeautyandthebroth.com and discount code RUNGA15. So what's your approach to diet? Like, I imagine, you know, that's probably...
I love talking about it.
You know, now that you're out of the closet and, you know, people know you exercise and eat well and, like, take vitamins. You know, the diet space right now is so
It's so wild, and I have no idea your approach to diet. But just like 2 weeks ago, you know, I was just, my son was, because my wife is predominantly vegan, but has, you know, especially over the last bunch of years of having children, you know, more salmon and eggs and things like that. But I was just looking and I was like, my son, like, we have to give him dairy. Like, we can get this like great A2 local family farm yogurt that's so good for him. Like, you know, I think he was drinking, because she has almond milk and stuff, and he was drinking it. And I was like, he's going old school. So again, I'm taking a little bit of a risk here, because I don't know what your dietary strategy is. But like, I sometimes think that like some of the dietary trends have kind of gone too far. So that's kind of my thought. But I would love to know, like, is diet, if you suspect mast cell, you suspect even Lyme, is diet a core element of the treatment? And then, like, what does that look like?
Yeah. And look, you know, there are going to be people where changing their diet is going to be the key to fixing everything. And for others, it's a part of it, but it cannot be ignored. Because we are what we eat. That's so cliche, but we are, it's true. And what I've come to believe over time is that, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to, like, you know, upset anybody in the audience who,
you don't have to worry. They're pretty well seasoned to, you know.
Okay, good. Good.
Lighthearted controversy.
Okay, yeah, I mean, right. And the thing is that, okay, good. You know, in 5 years, I might change my mind. I say, you know, like, I can change my mind. I might learn something that I don't know right now, okay? But my emphasis is animal protein.
Great.
That is by far, like, the best thing. I always emphasize that. And then within that category, I mean, there are going to be people who are vegan, but we slowly have to convert them to a more vegetarian, and then plant-based, but, you know, but having some animal protein on occasion, right? Maybe that's right for some people. And maybe some people thrive. I'm a true believer in true, like, I do personalized medicine. That's what I do. So everyone is different, and I don't think there is the perfect diet for everyone. I can say that I personally thrive on the carnivore diet, but that's me. And not, yeah, I love the carnivore diet. But that's me, you know, and my patients know that. And a lot of my patients will say, I can't do what you're doing, but what can I do that's kind of like that, right? So, yeah, so I work with my patients to figure out, but I think animal protein is, we are, you know, carnivore-ish by nature, by, you know, evolutionarily. I mean, we have enzymes, we're better at digesting animal protein than we are digesting plant protein. We are missing a lot of things that are necessary to digest and extract nutrients from plants. But I think that there are some people, maybe genetically, that can, they do a better job. Maybe their microbiome is different, and I think that's a big part of this. Maybe they can digest down those foods, and so they do better with plant-based food. So I don't want to discount that and say it's necessarily bad for everyone, but I find that at least in my population of patients, it's much harder to treat vegans in terms of getting them better. It just is. It's much harder to get the right nutrition, the right amount of protein on a vegan diet. Protein is so important on so many functions in the body. And so I'm a big protein pusher. So I want to get, you know, adequate protein. Animal source protein is going to be the easiest, best, you know, assimilated. So that's my approach. Now, within that category, I'm going to have patients who are allergic to meat. There's a condition called alpha-gal. They get bitten by a tick, and it causes this allergic reaction to meat. So they can't.
That's the worst. Allergic. That's the worst disease I've ever heard of.
Yeah, it's awful. And so we work with that. I mean, we got to figure that out. And sometimes that gets better over time. And so we, you know, again, we try to figure out how to get them adequate nutrition. So I work with everything. But my preference is to try to figure out how to get them on a higher animal-based. I love that. Protein.
And music to my ears. We got to figure out, like, you know, sidebar question. Like, what the heck is a tick's job? Like, why can't we just get rid of those things? They seem to be just a menace. So what do you mean by carnivore, I guess, is a question, right? Because, are you just, ribeyes 3 meals a day? Or what does it look like?
Yeah. Right. And that's the problem with carnivore, right? Because I use that term because it feels right to me because I'm eating animal protein. Mm-hmm. But I think everyone is different. I think the amount of fat that they need, the type of protein, type of animal, protein they're eating can differ. And I like variety. So I'm not I can't just eat beef all day. I could. I mean, I guess I could do that. And I have done that. But I like variety. And so I like my bison. I like, grass-fed, really, it's all grass-fed. But, I like, all kinds of meat and sometimes chicken. I love salmon, sardines, eggs. And so I try to kind of keep it different and whatever feels good to my body. But that for me is carnivore. I don't do dairy, but I'm allergic to dairy. So that just doesn't, I wish I could. But for me, just, keeping it simple and that's, I just listen to what makes me feel good.
I love that, and that's been my journey with dairy because, so my undergrad's in exercise physiology. There was a pretty large amount of nutrition and nutrition science in there. And that got me all like low fat and all this. And I just felt like garbage. And
yeah, we all did that. That's that was a phase.
And and then over the last 20 years, I feel like, my diet, I've always known that I actually do thrive on dairy. My DNA or whatever, I just do really well on it, especially either, full fat yogurt or I love like blocks of Parmesan cheese and I'll just like slice it. So even myself over the last 2 decades of being in this space, it's like, I've still been like, well, I'm not, I got to cut back on that. And, it's like cancer and, all of this stuff, right? Like you let it in and, I probably have dairy every day. And then I understand too, like, I'm curious on your approach to fasting, because that kind of seems like if we're going to go down the like animal products promote mTOR, I had a good friend that did a lot of cancer research and there's like, that's why you got to fast. He said like, eat whatever you want, but fast 3 days a month. So like the first 3 days of every month, just don't eat anything. And then you can eat whatever you want the other 27 days. And so that's kind of actually what I've been doing. Cause I just find that to be like, maybe it's not a get out of jail free card, but I like to just believe it is. And, so yeah, the dairy thing and then the meat thing and the, but there's, so I guess I have a quick question and then like, I'll just hand you the mic and there's not really a question here, but you know what I'm saying? There's, like, do you eat fruit or is it all meat?
No.
You eat all meat. Wow. Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah.
So that's.
Yeah. And I've learned, I've known from childhood that I needed protein. I have been since childhood insulin resistant. I've known that about myself. I've always known that I was very sensitive to sugar. I knew that I would get cranky and irritable. And so, once I kind of figured that out and I, through med school, through bodybuilding, through lots of things, kind of sort of figured out, I'm still figuring it out, right? I just know that anytime I listen to the noise, and this is what happens, I go to conferences, functional medicine conferences, and I talk to people who are in this, world with me, this field, and there's this talk about eating the rainbow, for diverse microbiome diversity. And I hear these buzzwords and I hear people like Jeffrey Bland talking about buckwheat, Tartary Himalayan buckwheat, and how it has all these, do you know about this? It's like all these nutrients and it's like phytochemicals and we need phytochemicals. And I listen to a lot of this noise and then I start to deviate and I'm like, maybe I need to be eating more greens and more whatever. It's sort of like you're thinking, you're like, I shouldn't be having dairy because I hear the dairy talk, And so, I would like try to, and I would, then I would, oh, my body always goes back to carnivore. Like I need my meat. And so I've just sort of said, all right, you know what? I can't listen to the noise anymore because there's always going to be someone talking about this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. But if I eat this way and I eat my meat and I work out and I do the things that I'm doing and meditate and take care of myself, then I don't, you know, I try not to worry about the noise, because my marker, you know, if I do my markers and I think about my own health, and if this is what has helped me be better, then it must be good. But it may not be good for everyone. So I just sort of like, I just think if you think dairy is good for you, then great. Then why not? Like, I try not to listen to those big stories like red meat is going to give you cancer. Well, you know, a lot of these research projects really are problematic. You know, they look at people, a lot of them are sort of retrospective. They look back, they say, oh, you have cancer. What kind of diet did you have? And sure, they're eating ribeyes and potatoes, baked potatoes, and the rolls and the butter and the other, all this other stuff, you know.
Hey, let's not talk bad about potatoes.
Sorry,
hey, whoa.
but you know, what you're combining your food with, you know, having carbs with the meat, maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's not the meat. So I just think we have to be careful, and we have to just really use, you know, a little bit more common sense when we think about some of these things. And again, look at the individual person. So the point being is that I think if you're eating meat and you figure out what the right amount of protein is for your body and what the right amount of fat is for your body, you know, maybe really high fat for some people who just don't metabolize fat well is going to be bad for them. Maybe that could predispose to cancers. But maybe for other people, it's not. Maybe their body thrives. They need more fat. Maybe they need to be in more of a ketosis type state. So I think it can vary, but my point is that I try not to get too overwhelmed with what the media thinks, you know? What was the other point that I
yeah, well, there's so much there, because there's this, like, I just love your approach, and I was so not expecting that you were a carnivore. So,
I know, I saw your eyes.
Like, whoa, this
yeah,
is,
you're like, whoa.
Well, it's so great, because, you know, I think, these days I never know how to word things, but like, women are just like generally eat too little protein, and they're like, you know, and in the gym they don't use more than like a pound, like 1 pound or something in their hands. And it, you know, even as a fitness professional, it's just like, you know, like we need to like, and so like, you're kind of a role model for women, because I think that when we look at, I remember in college, there's been so many sort of intuitive aha moments in my life, but in college, it's like, women are going to lose 20% of their bone density by the time they're this age. And it's like, well, why don't we just try to get it to 140%? Like, and so when they lose 20, they're not like, you know, risking dying because they fell. But then I want to share two quick stories with you, because before, because, you know, my dad, he had a heart attack actually when I was about 14 years old, 15 maybe. And he survived. But I remember, because my household, my dad was, he's Sicilian. He literally just like bread, pasta. That was about it. But like, we were food pyramid. The food pyramid was like on the fridge. So we were good, because, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And he had a heart attack, and I remember he like survives and comes out of surgery, and the doc's like, no more steak and eggs. And like, I was, you know, a young kid, but I was still like, when was the last time we had steak and eggs? Like, we don't eat fat. We just eat sauce and pasta. So it was like, even as a young kid. And then to your point, this idea of like, if it gives you the results you want, the energy you want, the feelings you want, the emotions you want, the whatever, it's like, it's got to be the right diet. Later on in my, you know, kind of career, like every time there's been like two or three waves of like the Atkins diet, like from the time I was, I was always paying attention to nutrition for whatever reason.
That's awesome.
And then when I was a trainer, it was sort of starting to bubble up, like, wouldn't it suck if the diet that makes, I'm just going to say fat people, the diet that makes people with serious weight problems lose the most weight gives them heart disease? Like, how, like, that would be such a curse, because like, people go on the Atkins diet, they lose like 100 pounds, And then they're like, but you did it the wrong way. Now you're going to get like, and so even before I had this, you know, I guess I was kind of fortunate. I was put on a really high fat diet in 2007, which was like 4 or 5 years after I was in this. But before that, I was like, this is just like, they're just like dot points of like this, something's fishy.
Exactly. And then there was all this, you know, this story that came out that Atkins died of a heart attack. You know, he did not.
Okay, I don't know the story. Yeah,
he fell.
Okay,
it was like an accident.
Gosh,
he died of accidental death. But the whole thing was that everyone was like, "Oh, Atkins died. He must have died from his diet. You know, from heart disease."
Right.
But yeah, no, it's interesting to hear, you know, how you've seen that those waves of things. I saw the same thing. I remember in med school. The big thing was the low-fat craze and the snack wells. I mean, how genius were those snack well cookies? I just can never forget that because I was like, wow, it's low-fat. So it must be fine for you. You can have as many cookies as you want because that's not the problem, right? Oh, my God.
When I was a little kid and we would go to the grocery store, this is not even a joke, I would get Skittles because it was low-fat. So M&Ms had fat. I actually wanted M&Ms, but I more or less had to get Skittles because it didn't have fat in it. Like that's what the 89, that's like the mid 90s in a nutshell is like, you're like choosing Skittles because it doesn't have fat.
Exactly. Oh,
goodness.
And really what I've come to understand, and I'm really hoping that people are starting to get it, is that insulin resistance. Sugar is the enemy, not fat. And I still think that a lot of people's diets are still too high in carbohydrates in general, and fruit included. You know, I'm not going to bash, you know, blueberries, I guess, for some people if they feel like, you know, they're getting some antioxidants. But you know, really, if you can't process all that sugar, it's going to cause inflammation. It's going to cause clogged arteries. It's going to cause heart disease. And the real root of heart disease is the insulin, pre-diabetes, metabolic syndrome, whatever term you want to use, that's the problem. And that's why increasing protein intake, which naturally increases your fat intake, actually combats that problem and actually should theoretically reverse it. And I say theoretically, but we have studies showing this. We have colleagues out there who are looking at, cardiologists who are looking at, you know, plaque disappear after people are going on grain-free or low-carb, keto, carnivore, whatever diet, the plaque is going away. Shouldn't the plaque be worse if you're eating, you know, all this, you know, fat and dairy and all that? No, it's disappearing. Interesting, you know. So, yeah.
You have good genes. But I'm so curious, Tanya, because, right. You know, because it's – so we started the conversation.
Yeah, sorry. We went
this
all
is
over
like,
the place.
No, but it's like – this is like actually beautiful for people because there's so much here. We started the conversation talking about cholesterol and Lipitor. And you mentioned you actually have clients on Lipitor. And now we've come full circle and it's like you eat nothing but meat. So like, right. and I know guys that do this and they believe that cholesterol is like the more the merrier sort of. So like, I'm just curious, like, you know, we don't have to dive into your blood, but like, what is like your general like approach to cholesterol? Like, or concern about it? Like if someone's listening and they're like, wow, like, you know, here's a doc that I trust and is, you know, and she's doing it. So what does this look like?
Because it's so nuanced. So I was there like some of your carnivore friends where I was like, it doesn't matter. You know, don't worry about the cholesterol. I was there for a little bit.
How long have you been doing this diet? I'm just like, how long have you been doing like either some variation or like hardcore, like
2015. Is when I started my carnivore journey. And I did it, so it's 8 years.
Wow.
I did it, you know, really, really hard. Yes, I was hardcore right from the beginning, maybe for a year or two. And then I started hearing the noise. And I actually had my own health journey, and I had a mold illness, and I had some colleagues who were like, you're sick because you were doing carnivore.
Right.
Oh, do you think that's what it was? So then I started, I got to incorporate some vegetables. And so then I, kind of like veered off a little bit. And then I was like, that's not right. I know my body. This has nothing to do with the diet. Let me go back. And because the diet, I think not being on the diet was actually making things worse. So I kind of have been like there, but definitely for the last.
That's longer than most people.
Yeah,
for sure.
It's a long time.
So what is there a general cardiovascular philosophy that you kind of I know it's nuanced and you're probably looking at a lot of stuff and but can you share any, how could we quell people's concerns if they're listening and they're thinking about, not having potatoes anymore?
Right. So the first thing I think that is when you're going down this path, and let's say you decide you want to just become carnivore, you just want to eat animal protein, you will see usually a little bit of a spike in cholesterol. That's not uncommon. The body, the liver is detoxing. There's a lot of things going on. But if it stays high, and I'm looking at family history, so if I have patients who's parents, father, had a heart attack at 40 years old, and I have a patient, they're 40, and their numbers are borderline, that maybe they look a little pre-diabetic or they're going in that direction, their cholesterol isn't great, their triglycerides are a little high. So the first step, actually changing the diet, will be helpful, but maybe it's not going to be enough to reverse their risk. Maybe that genetic susceptibility is really strong. So I'm going to look at a lot of markers. I'm a big data person. I like data. I have to look at the patient. I'm not only treating numbers, but I like data. I like to look at, I'll look at the cholesterol, all those numbers, LDL, HDL, but I'll look at, and triglycerides, and I'll look at apolipoprotein B. I'll look at lipoprotein, little a. These are things that we're starting to understand maybe are better predictors of cardiovascular health and disease.
And those are markers about, sorry to jump in, Doc. Those are the size or the sort of those tests are kind of looking not at how many there are, but what each molecule kind of looks like, or?
No, that's, I do that too. Okay. I do the particle sizes and things like that. Apolipoprotein B is a carrier, actually. It's a carrier protein of these other cholesterol molecules, and that can give us some information. But I will look at particle size and really whether the cholesterol is oxidized or not, if we can measure that. Sometimes we can't, it's not that easy to get in the lab these days, but if I can see whether the cholesterol has been oxidized and is the type of cholesterol that's more likely to stick to the walls of the blood vessels. So I'm looking at those factors. I might do a CAT scan and look at one of those heart scans, calcium scores, to look at if there's plaque building up. Maybe I'll do carotid ultrasound to see if there's plaque in their carotids, because I could use the diet, but I know the diet's going to take time. Or maybe the genetics are so strong that the diet is not going to be enough. Then I'm going to balance their risk with, if they have plaque building up already, all right, maybe I've got to intervene sooner. Sure, I have supplements and herbs and things that I like to use, but I might still say, I don't know if the risk is too high not to be on something anyway. So again, it's different. Everyone is going to be different. I look a lot at endothelial function. So the lining of your arteries, this is part of the problem. You want really smooth arteries. The blood should flow through, right, and go everywhere in the body. But insulin resistance is one thing. But infections, stressors, other things can kind of destroy the layer inside that artery. It kind of damages it, and that damage creates a little sort of pocket for stuff to plaque to sit. It's sort of it kind of creates this nice environment where, I'll just stick here. So the integrity of the artery is really, really important. And so I think about there are lots of different types of herbs or supplements that I use for that. And being on the right diet and controlling insulin resistance. And say, maybe some people need metformin. Maybe they need one of these GLP-1 agonists. Maybe the diet is going to be enough, or maybe I need to help them along the way. And that's the problem I have a little bit with some of these communities, you know, the carnivore community or the vegan community. It doesn't matter, right? And I think that's kind of how you started this. You know, it's a little bit hardcore. And I buy into a lot of what they're saying, but I think that, you know, on an individual level, maybe, you know, they need a little help, or we need to make sure we need to modulate their risk. You know, if they're going to have a heart attack, is there something that we can do in addition to the diet that, you know, might be helpful? That's how I look at it.
No, it's wonderful. And yeah. And so there's this, like, there's the camps that are like fitting everyone to the diet. And then, you know, it's about fitting the diet kind of the other direction. And like, when you do it the other direction, you still kind of can hang out with that crowd, but a lot of the people in that crowd don't have the full picture. But there's something there in terms of if, like, you know, I don't know if this is the best question, but like, so if suddenly you had some sort of really, like, heaven forbid, some sort of really stressful, traumatic event, would you change your diet in any way? Like, because if stress is hurting the endothelial function and that increases the concern around dietary cholesterol, right, or whatever, you know, or however you want to answer it. I'm just curious about, like, the...
That's a good question.
Do you start with lifestyle before you go full-blown carnivore, or do you go carnivore and let that drive your lifestyle?
Both. Right? Depending on the patient. So I've made the mistake of changing my diet. And that was me. Like, I thought, I listened to the functional medicine world, and they said, you know, you need plant,
fiber,
you know, and more plants, fiber. Right, exactly. And that's what's going to make you better. And being carnivore was what hurt you. And in fact, no, it just was bad luck. I had a really bad mold exposure. And regardless of the diet I was on, I mean, that's the thing people have to remember, is that, like, there are lots of things that we can do to protect ourselves. Eating the right way, following the right lifestyle, meditating, but things happen in life. And so there are things that are out of our control. And so I think that if I had to do it again, right, I would not have changed the diet. I think it may have had a different trajectory and a better trajectory. But yeah, I think you stick to what works for you. Yeah. You know, what makes sense to you. That's really the bottom line.
Right on. Thank you so much. I know we're kind of over time here. It was funny when you came out, it was like just like a whole, like, you know, all of a sudden it was like I was like a, you know, jack in the box. Like, oh my gosh, I have like 1,000 extra questions.
I love it. I love to talk. We're good.
Okay, amazing. We'll go another few minutes. And then, you know, I want you to share where people can find your work and where people can kind of explore deeper and hire you for help if they're circulating around the medical system. But I guess my final question is, I have allowed my 3-year-old since he started eating food, which, by the way, his first food was egg yolk. I've really had a hands-off sort of curious approach to his diet. And I've been sort of like the core person feeding him. My wife does a ton. She's a chef. She's amazing. But I've been such a student of this kid that I have kind of, like, you know, taken over a lot of his diet. And so he was full on carnivore when he started eating. Even now, if we put broccoli or anything like that on his plate, he calls it weeds. He says, like, and he will have a bite. Like, if we make tacos or something and there's cilantro, he'll literally, like, take a bite and then identify the cilantro and, like, get it out. It's like so funny. It's like, if this was a natural, I watch him when I put cheese in front of him. I watch him when I put eggs in front of him. I watch him when I put broccoli. It's just like, there's something we should listen to here, because this kid doesn't know about the fat hypothesis, doesn't know about the food pyramid, doesn't know about all these things.
Exactly. Oh, I love that.
But there's one experiment I do with him often, and I've seen it shift over the last couple of years, is I would put like a pile of meat, a pile of avocado, a pile of bananas, a pile of potatoes, and I would just see what he
like gravitates to. Right. And it was for a long time. There's natural ebbs and flows. He has weeks where he's eating a ton and weeks where he eats only a little. He has weeks where he eats tons of protein and weeks where he goes more carbs. He loves mangoes. He loves bananas. So whatever comes up for you in that story, I'd be curious about. And then my other question would be, is there an age component? Like, my kid is so insulin sensitive and has no like issues. So like naturally, like as we get older, like I should probably be lower carb maybe. And I guess he can handle probably more carbohydrate than I can. And like, I can probably handle more carbohydrate than my mother. Like, you know, it's so like, is there an age thing? And like, would you, if you could go back in time, would you be a carnivore from like 2 years old, or would you have not?
Yeah, so I'll start with that. Actually, I'll go backwards because, yeah, I mean, my mother tells stories about, you know, the minute I could hold a chicken leg, I think I was probably 6 months old. You know, the minute I could start gnawing on a chicken drumstick, I was. Wow. You know, I had meat in my mouth from a very young age. So I wish I wasn't exposed to all the other things that generation thought. You know, they were sort of, they knew what they knew. And then all of a sudden the convenience stuff, right? Cause I was, you know, born in the 70s, and then, you know, the 80s, you know, was tough. There was a lot of, you know, more processed type foods. And so then, you know, then you're exposed to people around you and friends, and everyone's eating crap. And so, you know, I wish I could have just kept the way I was as a child and sort of the way your son is. But I do think, you know, you talk about age, and I think age definitely makes a difference. So yes, the younger people are more insulin sensitive, but I think I was already insulin resistant when I was younger, but I was more insulin sensitive than I am now. That's for sure. Like, that does change over time. But I think kids are still born. There are some genetically who are born with a predisposition already to being more insulin resistant. So I think that, so that's maybe part of the answer. The other thing about that experiment is that as he's getting older and you're exposing him to more foods, you know, the palate advances. It does change, right? So if you only gave him meat all the time and you gave him a pile of burgers, a pile of chicken, a pile of liver, you know, maybe, you know, he would gravitate to the meat, not the liver. I mean, right, who knows? But if you start adding, you know, a pile of bananas and a pile of mangoes and sweet stuff, right? We have a sweet tooth.
Yeah, skew.
Yeah, we'll start to gravitate. And so people who say to me, I can't eat meat, it's, you know, it's really, they have, you know, aversions to it. That's years of programming, not eating meat. That's years of eating carbohydrates, and the body learning, that the tongue, the taste buds learning what it wants, right? And what I find interesting is that when I, because I've done the experiment where I was full carnivore and then was like, oh, I maybe this is not good, so I'm going to eat some vegetables and maybe some blueberries. And my taste buds changed, and I found that I was not gravitating to meat the same way. And as soon as I go back to meat, that's all I crave is meat. So So I think that sort of speaks to, you know, the kids. So I am a big fan of variety for children, though. And I struggle with this, even with my own kids. You know, what really should they be eating? Because, again, there's a lot of noise. There's just a lot of noise. You know, do we want the kids to have a more well-rounded palate? Do we want them to be exposed to lots of nutrients? Do we want them to really be exposed to what I think is best for them and meat? You know, I don't, you know, it's a tough answer.
I mean, it's a impossible question in terms of, you know, my 3-year-old, right? We signed him up. We waited on a year for the wait list of this little school. We finally got him in. And then it changed owners. And the definition of healthy food changed dramatically. So now my kid is like programmed that he doesn't eat the food at school. You know, it's just, he like always has his own snacks. And then, but that raises the next thing with the carnivore diet. Like, it's very hard to send a kid to like even a half day, which my son does, with like a pile of
burgers. It's like, you know, so it's an interesting conundrum. And, you know, and you mentioned the 80s, and gosh, we could go on all day, but there's something around, I researched this stuff a long time ago, but you mentioned like in the 80s, like the marketing really picked up, and it's a little bit like we made all these kind of national level changes to diet during like World War II. And then after World War II ended, we were like, well, let's just keep doing that because it was really profitable. And then all the marketing companies, but I found this document, it was, I think it was USDA from like the 30s. It's somewhere on my computer. I could share it with you. And the way it articulated, because this is like post-depression and like the way it articulated how to like manage your diet was so perfect. It was like talking about how much meat and dairy you need to have every day. And then the recommendations around beans and maybe peanut butter and, you know, a couple of things like this. It was like, when you don't have meat, use beans. When you can't get milk, like, so it was like these foods were presented as like shelf stable emergency foods post-depression, like, you know, maybe towards the beginning of World War II. And it was just like, that's how we need to be thinking about these plant foods. That the Heart Association, literally right now, as of a few months ago when I was on the site, the top two recommended protein sources on the American Heart Association are nuts and beans. And so I did the math and I was like, okay, so if I got 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day from the top two sources of protein, my calories are through the roof.
Oh, and the number of carbohydrates to get that amount of protein.
Not to mention, I'd
talk about insulin resistance. Not to mention what your gut is.
Right. I wouldn't be able to work because I'd just be in the bathroom all day. It's just like, so it's nonsensical, this approach. And told me you're dying. When you told me your diet, it was just like, oh my gosh, this is like, because I eat fruit and all sorts of stuff, but like, I'm intrigued by.
But you gravitate towards animal protein. That's the bottom line.
Big time.
Right. And that's what I really think. And that's the thing, like, I say this all the time. I want to be carnivore. That's what's best for me. But just a heavier animal protein diet. And yes, for you, you know, if you, and you work out and you need some carbs and you have natural, you know, some fruit and some vegetables or whatever, and you're thriving and your body is doing well, then that's great. You know? So I think it's, again, really, really personal.
Yeah. All right.
There's no right or wrong. Yeah. Anyway.
Thank you, Doc. This has been awesome, Tanya. Thank you so much for being here. It's been a really enjoyable show. It was like, you know, got really kind of self-interested and like, oh, how are you doing this? But where can people find you, especially if they've got, you know, they're in the medical system, maybe they're circulating around, they've gotten 10 specialist opinions on it. You know, where do they find you? Are you on social media? If you could share all that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on Facebook, Dr. Tanya Dempsey, Instagram, Dr. Tanya Dempsey, MD. My website, drtanyadempsey.com. My practice is AIM Center for Personalized Medicine. I'm in Purchase, New York. It's Westchester County. So my website for that is AIM, A-I-M, Center, P as in Peter, as in M as in Mary. So aimcenterpm.com. And I blog a lot. I have a YouTube channel too. And I do tons of podcasts and you know, educational stuff. I just want to get the word out. I'm not taking on new patients in 2023. I'm trying to, hopefully we'll open again in 2024. But I have two great colleagues in my office that aren't seeing new patients. I have Dr. Larry Afrin here, who's really the world's leader in mast cell activation syndrome, and Dr. Colin Renard, who's my PA, who is doing great work. He has a background in chiropractic medicine, so he has an interest in nutrition, and he has an interest in the stuff that I'm doing and functional medicine. So we're seeing people. We have ozone therapy, IV therapy. I have my own line of vitamins and.
I love it. Wow.
And that's aimstore.net is my store. So lots of places to find me.
So great. Thank you so much, Tanya. This has been awesome. And we'll link all to that, everything you just mentioned in the show notes. But for those that are listening, you know, in the gym or something, they can go to your Instagram and stuff right now. Thank you so much. This has been very educational and very enjoyable. And I really appreciate you making the time and going way over time as well. So thank you so much.